The following podcast is a production of Institutional Real Estate Incorporated. Before beginning our program, we would like to invite you to sign up for a free trial subscription to one of our publications at irei.com. Whether you are interested in real estate, infrastructure, or real assets in general, IREI has a publication to suit your needs. Select Publications on the main menu to choose a publication. Interested in more than one? Sign up for them all.
I love Africa, and I've been twice now. My husband and I went with some friends a few years back, and interestingly, we went because Bernstein does this thing where every 5 years you get every fifth anniversary you have as an employee, you get something called a refresh period, where they say you get 2 extra weeks of vacation. We want you to take it all at once. We want you to get off the grid. You know, just don't, like, really, this is truly meant to refresh. It's like a very, very mini sabbatical. And so I found out, I didn't even know this perk existed, and Dave Barnard, who runs our business, sent me an email and said, congratulations, where do you want to go on your 2 weeks? And I thought, what? And that weekend, a friend of ours was chatting about the fact that he'd always wanted to go hike Kilimanjaro. This was, like, on his bucket list. I'd always wanted to go. It's just to visit the African continent. So we ended up going with 2 couples, my husband and I, to Tanzania. We stayed in Arusha for a while. We hiked. We climbed Kilimanjaro. We went on the safari. It was just amazing. And I hadn't been back. That was a few years back. I hadn't been back. And then this past spring break with our kids, we ended up going to southern Spain and then just taking the ferry down to Morocco and then traveled throughout Morocco, through the Atlas Mountains, slept out in the Sahara Desert, and it was absolutely amazing. Still on that continent, but could not have been a more dramatically different experience. And I just want to go back. But now I'm just, obsessed with getting back there and checking out more of it, just seeing the vast differences in cultures, on that continent. So that's probably my favorite part of the world so far. I grew up in a town, Newton, Massachusetts, which is right outside of Boston. My childhood was very lively. I guess I would describe it as that. So I can qualify that. I'm the third of 3 children. My siblings are 6 years and 8 years older than me. And I grew up with parents who really lived by the mantra of work hard, play hard. We had a big, close-knit Irish Catholic family, just a big, crew of cousins and aunts and uncles and family friends who all played a really significant part of my life and just our general universe as we were growing up. So it was, I think lively is a good word to describe it. I love solving puzzles of all kinds. Like, I'm obsessed with jigsaw puzzles, and I will stay up all night until I can complete a jigsaw puzzle. I love solving problems for clients where they have, in Bernstein is a great place to be because our clients have significant wealth and a lot of complexity, and I love figuring out solutions for the various aspects of their lives. I love, even on the weekends, we'll have a massive pile of laundry, and just getting through all of it, having it all folded and getting it into everyone's rooms. Like, I'm huge about like writing a to-do list at the beginning of the day and being able to check things off. I really enjoy getting it done. Other people often have described me as intense. And so I might say that there is a certain intensity about me where when I start to focus on something and getting something done or working through something or pushing forward an agenda or positive change, I get incredibly intense about it. When I am happy for someone, I am intensely happy for someone. When I am frustrated about something, I have a really short fuse. I do and live, I think, things very intensely. And I'm one of those people who wants to be able to do it all. But I have failed in multiple situations in the work environment. I started out in social work. I was in social services. It was an environment where I was promoted into a management position when I was maybe 24 years old, managing, you know, over a dozen people who are truly the working poor, you know, in our economy. When you look at what frontline service providers in the social services arena are making, and most of them were twice my age, and I was terrible. I'm an incredibly impatient person, which I just mentioned to you, which doesn't equate to being a very strong social worker. And I am, I had no management skills whatsoever. And that was part of the reason that I went back to school. I went to the University of Chicago. There's a school called the School of Social Service Administration. And so I studied there at night over the course of a few years and got my master's in social work. There's very much an administrative track. Interestingly, while I was there, I realized that I didn't want to be in social services at all. But that experience of being promoted into a position for which I had absolutely no, you know, experience and credibility from the other people who were supposed to be reporting to me was definitely a lesson learned, and a lesson in humility too, for sure. Because a lot of those folks were on my team, I remember, were immigrants from other countries who had had pretty significant roles. They had been teachers. They had been one gentleman had been a professor. They had, you know, had these roles in other countries and had to come to the United States for various reasons. And then they're supposed to be reporting to this 24-year-old. It was just really an unbelievable experience. I will say that working in and around the nonprofit sector for all these years since then, the sector has changed dramatically since that time. But that was my experience. I am a saver and have absolutely, from the time that my brother and sister and I were little children, my parents instilled in us this ethos that we needed to live within our means. That was sort of our money message growing up. And so Adam and I, my husband and I, definitely live a relatively modest lifestyle. We sock away money. I buy clothes on consignment and thrift. People think I'm crazy, but I'm so proud of myself. And they'll say, "Ooh, I love that sweater." I'll be like, "Yeah, I got it from ThredUp, which is like the consignment app." And it's also good for the environment to do that. So I am very cost conscious. I want to be able to make decisions and make choices throughout my life and throughout my retirement, and I want for my kids to be able to make choices that aren't based solely on the premise of what it costs. So I want to have that financial freedom. We've also been through, my husband and I, situations where the money wasn't coming in, and so we've lived that as adults. I remember just prior to joining Bernstein, I had been at, for about a decade, a community development bank, a CDFI, Community Development Finance Institution. And what I had done there is I had grown and managed the not-for-profit and foundation banking practice. It became sort of the national institutional banking practice for them. The credit crisis happened. We weren't making subprime loans in any of the low-income neighborhoods where we were doing business, but everyone else on all of those blocks were, and the bank was in distress. I knew that as part of management, I was really on the chopping block. And so I committed to stay through rate recapitalizing, which we did. It reopened under a new name, but I was out. And at the same time that the credit crisis was occurring, my husband was a commodity futures trader. And he had some really good years. He was never sort of the hugest, you know, player in his office. He worked for a sort of what they call a prop shop or, you know, proprietary firm. But he had gone out on his own, and he had made money in trading, and then he was losing money in trading. And while this was all happening, we had two babies at home. Our girls are less than 2 years apart. And these different banks in Chicago reached out to me when they knew that that my bank was under distress. And I went and I did informational interviews, and I thought to myself, this is just not something I want to do. My father had been a stockbroker, and this just seems like a bad model, I don't want to do it. Bernstein called, and they had a different model. I knew that Bernstein was a research firm first and foremost. I had clients at our bank that were Bernstein clients, and it clicked in terms of the culture of the institution. But I think more importantly, at that moment, I was going to get paid a salary and have health care. I needed a J-O-B. And that's the kind of thing that, you know, if you live through that, it's not like Adam and I didn't have savings, but I don't want to have to be there again. It was okay when we were in our late 20s and early 30s, but I don't want to have to be there when I'm in my 60s and 70s. I'm definitely risk tolerant, and I think that's a function of this is what I do for a living, and we operate in decades when we're doing planning work with the nonprofits and foundations that we work with, when we're doing, you know, work with private clients, individuals and families. We're really looking very, very long term, and that's what my financial plan and Adam's financial plan is all about. It's long term. So a day like today, with the market, the stock market outcomes, that's okay. I'm comfortable with that type of risk, and I'm not going to go try to pull my money out because of that. My favorite asset—it's not necessarily an asset class. But my favorite types of assets are really different types of responsible investment portfolios. That was my first entree into really the investing universe. Was when I was at the CDFI, we were the cash allocation of a number of what they called back then SRI portfolios, or socially responsible investing portfolios. And so when I moved over to Bernstein, a quote-unquote mainstream firm, I was really tired of having gone to these SRI conferences year after year and sort of saw the same people attending, preaching in the choir. And I was excited to join a firm that was just starting to embark on thinking about building out what we now call purpose-driven portfolios, but really looking at environmental and social and governance factors alongside traditional financial metrics, and then measuring those and being able to say to our clients, look, actually this portfolio is outperforming its sort of non-quote-unquote responsible peers. And we engage with these municipalities or these companies on ABC issues, and that was a risk factor we weren't comfortable with. So we pulled that company from the portfolio. So I love the idea of being able to achieve measurable impact that can be positive for the community and the environment while at the same time achieving your financial goals. I am definitely most productive on some type of a time crunch, so on a deadline, which can work to my advantage, but also can be obviously not be helpful to myself or for the people around me. But I also work very well, and I thrive when I have variety, when there are multiple items on my plate that I'm juggling. Some people just do not like that. They can only focus on one thing at a time. I really enjoy being able to work on multiple projects in one day and then sometimes see the themes throughout seemingly very different things that we can see pulled together across our business. So, I'm a working mom. I have two kids. We never really went the nanny route, and so I have always been forced to be somewhat efficient and productive with my time. I'm probably working somewhere around 50 hours a week. Then, in our business, there are events, right, that we're attending. I do travel, so that is, obviously, I pack in a lot of hours of work when I'm traveling. There are the occasional evenings that I'm, you know, back online and doing things like that. And the flip side of it is, in our business, we're not on the clock. We're creating our own calendars. And so we're really our own worst enemies, or I am my own worst enemy in terms of I could work all the time. I know I can't and I shouldn't. And so blocking off those sort of dinner time hours when possible to be with my kids, right? I see them early in the morning before I head out. And when they have anything at school, or if they have sporting events, or they have a doctor's appointment, or something like that, my husband and I can just tag team and we can go. And I know I've put in, I've clocked in a lot of hours, and I'm fully comfortable taking that time and having that flexibility. And I'd also say I am very conscious of sending that message to the people on my team, our associates, and the people who are looking at how I operate, because I want them to see that that's okay to have a life, and that you're permissioned to have a life outside of work. And I can be a mom, I can have a family, and I can have a successful career, and it works. Obviously, I like to surround myself by people who are successful or who have achieved success in some way. It's fascinating to learn their stories, and of course, those make for great clients as well. I also, particularly, I think I'm drawn to, and maybe vice versa, when I look at some of the clients on my private clients, philanthropic types of, you know, type of clients, those are people who are really grateful for what they've achieved and what they have, and they enjoy getting back to the community. And so philanthropy or some sort of charitable vehicle is a part of their overall financial plan, and frankly, it's why I work with them. So the other thing is I have an aversion to people who just see problems and want to talk about negative things that are going on but don't do anything about it. I'm very much a proactive person, and so I like to surround myself with people who have a sort of positive energy, who aren't satisfied with the status quo, but they will do something about it, right? They'll get out there. They'd rather, you know, engage with other people at work or across the broader community to sort of seek out positive change. Absolute first thing I do when I put my bag down is I text, we have a group text to Dee Dee and Katie and Adam and me. So just, I will text them and say, like, hey, make it a great day. I'll do some stupid emojis. But that's basically it. It's a text check-in with them. And then I put my phone away. And then I feel like I can start my day. I took the Myers-Briggs assessment a long, long time ago, and it stated that I was just way, way off the charts on the extroversion side of things. So I really don't like, it's not that I can't be alone, but I enjoy people. The most formative experience of my professional career, I would have to say, was when I joined Bernstein, because it was when I first joined, it was 9 years ago. I had always been in the nonprofit sector in philanthropy and then in community development banking, so certainly in financial services, but a very different part of financial services. I had always had women as my supervisors. You know, the nonprofit sector is a, I would say, more diverse, just demographically group than private wealth traditionally. And so we do these Monday morning meetings at our office and across the firm. Once a month, we have a national where everyone video conferences in. And then every week in Chicago, there's this room called the Partnership. It's a massive boardroom, long boardroom table. It seats about 50 people. And I come in and I look around the table, and it's entirely 100% white men, mostly a lot older than me, middle aged. And at that time, Bernstein was business formal. And so I looked around, and the first thing that crossed my mind was they all, a number of them had French cuffed cufflinks on. I thought the last time that I saw so many cufflinks was my high school prom. I was just like, what did I do? I do not fit in here. I was terrified. And so I knew it had been a risk to make the leap, and I needed a job, and I had been intrigued by private wealth, and I'd been intrigued by somehow parlaying that into continuing to work with not-for-profits and foundations more broadly than I had been able to do at the bank. But I thought, okay, I think I just bit off way more than I can chew here. And so it's really interesting when I look back, and then I went to New York for 3 months, for training, or actually 4 months for training, which we don't do at Bernstein anymore. We have a little bit of a more flexible model. I just made a decision that morning, like at that moment, like, okay, like I'm all in. I'm like, I'm going to do this. There is no choice. I will make this work. But it was a moment where I was absolutely terrified and thought, I don't fit into this industry. I don't fit into this place. I just, oh my gosh. So interestingly, now in my job, I say that that was such a formative experience because I ultimately was successful as an advisor and grew a successful practice and gained the respect of my colleagues across the firm. And now in management, one of my responsibilities as the managing director in Chicago is recruiting and hiring new advisors. And my strategy is 100% reaching out into new markets into which we haven't had any or really strong reach in the past. Because while the financial services, or I would say the private wealth part of financial services is potentially lagging many other industries in terms of its diversity. Sometimes I joke and say it's the last bastion of the old boys network. The face of wealth is changing. New networks are popping up all over the place. And if we don't have reach into more diverse markets, and if we don't have a variety of perspectives, and if we're not able to meet potential clients where they're at, we'll be left behind. We will not succeed long-term as a firm. And so that's been my strategy. That's who I'm hiring. And I have a team now that looks entirely different than that boardroom table when I started 9 years ago. And I'm really proud of that. The jury's still out, but so far so good. Folks are starting to see some real success. So I think that was a very formative moment in my career. My career has progressed in a way, and I've crossed over so many sectors that I'd say I've had a number of turning points. But I would go back to that moment when I started at Bernstein, which really, I think, the major turning point for me. I realized, not right when I began, but I guess when I started to see success as an advisor at Bernstein, I realized that I had actually found the right mix and the right environment for me to use my skills to make an impact, both at a firm, but much more broadly than I had ever been able to do in the nonprofit sector at the community bank that I had been at. This is a much larger, more a major global firm, and I realized that I have game. I can do this. And I had not ever experienced, I hadn't been at a firm of this size prior, so I really hadn't challenged myself in that way. I've been charged with accomplishing a lot of things since the beginning. I started as an advisor, and so I was charged with growing a practice. I grew a practice and became a principal, this was in 2016. No, it was earlier than that. I don't remember, but I grew a practice and became a principal. And then from there, when I became a director and then a managing director, my charge has really been, one of my charges has been to enhance the experience, the culture of our office, as I referenced earlier, to diversify our advisor base, to really become a leader. Across our in a role model for my other peers across the private client business, in really creating the next generation of our advisor force. So I feel like I've been charged with a number of those things. And then with the endowment and foundation advisory services role, that was created a little over a year ago. And what I've been charged with there, I'll give a little background to help give you some context. We've grown up over the course of 50 years as a private client business at Bernstein, but over those years, we organically, across the country, built out a robust not-for-profit and foundation business to the tune of about $6 billion in assets overall. And that is split pretty much 50-50, public charities, associations, religious organizations like churches and synagogues and the like. And then the other 50% is private foundations, family foundations, really private philanthropy. And what we had never done is we have never intentionally marketed to this office, to this audience, either of these audiences. We had grown these relationships because our advisors are really good, and they have happy clients who happen to be on boards of directors or happen to be, you know, in different situations where they refer them into to business or into competitive situations, and it's built over time. The world is changing, and for these markets as well as others, you really do need to have infrastructure in place, different types of reporting, for not-for-profit organizations, for instance, and accounting types of reporting. We didn't even have a landing page on our website. Don't right now, but we will in another quarter. Building out materials so that we're enhancing the advisor's ability across the collective abilities across the country to enter into competitive situations and win additional business, but also to better serve those clients that exist with us today. And so just like other parts of our private client business, we're researching, we're collaborating with our portfolio managers to figure out the most efficient and the best ways to invest not-for-profit client dollars. We're looking at what's the right suite of services, and we just keep enhancing. And so my long story short, my job is to build out that intentional structure for the endowment and foundation business to best position us for growth looking forward. My management style is definitely casual, open, accessible, but I hold myself to very high standards, and I hold the people who report to me to high standards. We meet regularly. There are no surprises whatsoever when mid-year review comes around, when year-end review comes around, because we are having an ongoing dialogue and communication, and I'm a firm believer in transparency and direct feedback as quickly as possible, because that's what sticks. I'll just define who our target audience is in terms of the private client business to give you context for the full suite of services. In our private client business, and by the way, we have a whole institutional business where we have we're managing assets for very, very large institutions. But it tends to be a sort of product by product, sale. Within the private client business, we tend to partner with organizations and foundations that don't have an in-house investment team. They tend to have very lean finance offices. And the governance model is a little bit looser than, these fully built out into the largest institutions, the largest cultural institutions, and then universities and whatnot. So the investment decisions are driven by investment committees. These are volunteer boards of directors who are really smart people, but they are also extraordinarily busy. And so these types of organizations, and they range in size dramatically, but these types of organizations really need a true partner in helping them fulfill their collective duties as fiduciaries. So our answer to that is that we've really built out a holistic suite of both investment services but other ancillary related services. And I always describe it in four key areas. We actually have a one-pager now that sort of describes it too. So we start with governance because that is what organizations, our investment fiduciaries, should be mindful of, right? That there has to be that consistency and that transparency in why they made the decisions that they did and what the process was. So we use our forecast tools as a research firm to draft and maintain investment policies, spending policies. We work with organizations and their procedures for gift acceptance and the like. And it really is about not just the what in terms of the guardrails and the targets for allocation and risk and success measurement, but it's got to be providing institutional memory as to why. And then from there, we build out the portfolios. So we build out portfolios for short and intermediate term reserves, long horizon accounts, endowments or quasi-endowments. We do a lot with 403B plans now, so the retirement plans for nonprofits. And we act as an extension of the finance office. So I guess that's the third area. So some folks in the industry might call it OCIO or outsourced CIO. Our program is a little bit broader than that, but it does include all of the reporting that an organization needs. So who needs what data, in what format, on what schedule. We work on onboarding new committee members. You know, we're in close contact with, you know, the reporting contacts and staff. We're working with their auditors. And then the fourth and final area of our, I'd say, our suite of services is really with fundraising support. We work with so many ultra-high net worth and high net worth donors within our private client business that we have this whole ready library of resources for development teams that are often lean as well at these organizations. So it could be plug-and-play sort of content for their outreach. We do a lot of sessions, informational sessions, where we will do educational sessions and speaking, you know, gigs for the major donors for organizations. So that gives you sort of a sense of what we're doing. We're really focused on partnering with, or being a strategic partner and saying, look, it's your investments and how they're allocated in your performance versus benchmark is important, but it's not operating in isolation from your spending or from the inflows in the portfolio or all of these other things. We really want to think holistically about their financial success. Yeah, that was our that's the opening of our balancing structure and flexibility report, which is a really great primer for committee members and for decision makers in terms of investment policy statements, actually. So, yeah, I will summarize some of the challenges for you in three areas. So, number one, I think for organizations that are raising funds and for foundations that are granting out funds, there's a lot of policy uncertainty out there in terms of if and when and where government dollars are going to come, right, looking ahead. And that's been a major source of support for a lot of organizations in this very tenuous environment. So that's one. The second is, you know, inflows from individual donors and private support. So, you know, Giving USA does this very widely read report every year on, you know, where did Americans give last year? And giving is slowing. So I know that in 2018, the total, I'm just trying to look through some stuff here, total giving, I'm just seeing if I can find this, giving by individuals was down. Yeah, I knew that. So it was down by 1.1% from 2017. So it went from, it was $292 billion, which was down significantly, and that's down 3.4% inflation adjusted. That's a huge concern for organizations, because if you can get individual dollars, you know, contributed, you have so much more flexibility, you know, around what you can do with them versus government grants or even a lot of foundation grants. So that's a major, major concern. And then from our perspective, we couple that with where we are in the, you know, across the investment landscape. You look back over the last decade until recently, and we had fairly smooth sailing in terms of particularly U.S. stocks, the stocks really growing pretty consistently, coupled with historically low levels of volatility, coupled with historically low, or, you know, very low levels of inflation. It was a really great environment for investors, particularly in sort of the long-only space. And if you look ahead, we've been talking to clients about this, and this is a bit of what was in that report last year. As we look ahead, we do not project the next 10 years to look like the last. But we expect to see more volatility. We expect to see higher volatility coupled with lower returns across major asset classes. So think your long-only stocks, your bonds, and we're in it. Like we are entering into that period that we've been talking about, and so we are busy having a lot of conversations with clients about how do you deal with that, right? How do you deal with this environment where you're seeing challenges on the inflow side and you're seeing challenges on the portfolio side? The endowment models that are employed by institutions like Yale, for instance, there are significant benefits to that, you know, those types of models, but you're talking about institutions with billions of dollars to invest in, really steady inflows, right? So institutions that have the flexibility or the luxury to lock up, you know, quite a bit more in terms of their assets. So I would say there are pros and cons, right, to that type of model. And it doesn't always work, right? We've seen plenty of environments where you know, like there are some, you know, areas where it's very successful and others where you might question it. But in terms of our investing approach to foundations and endowments and maybe some of our advice today, looking ahead, because folks are saying, well, what do? You know, first of all, we have to meet everyone where they're at. We do work with a really wide range of institutions, helping them understand just strategically the purpose of different pools of assets, ensuring in this environment that they have enough near-term reserves for unforeseen liquidity shortages, right? Like maybe some government funding doesn't come in that they've always received before, those types of things. And really understanding from them what aspect of that quote-unquote sort of holistic suite of services that we provide is most critical to that organization or that group. And so our investment model is unique across the industry. We have an integrated approach. You may have learned about this from us in the past. We have an integrated approach to investment management. So essentially what we do, which is very different than the majority of our peers out there, is we intentionally build out different pieces of the allocation or different portfolios that are, from the get-go, designed to work together from a risk and a return and a diversification perspective. So we do this because we are an asset manager. We actually do have and have continued to acquire teams across the globe, across asset classes. We have folks that are really building these portfolios. So we do that and figure out the best ways to talk to each other and collaborate and build out those portfolios rather than the very prevalent outsourcing model where you have a consultant or an advisor who outsources the different pieces to different third-party asset managers right across the universe. They don't know each other, and they certainly don't know the client. You could argue the pros and cons of either model. This is just how we do it. For index tracking vehicles, we actually research the lowest cost with the least dispersion from the relative index, and so we don't build that. It doesn't make sense. And then for alternatives and a variety of sort of private investments and focused equity strategies, we continue to acquire teams. Burnsie has become this incredible landing place for some of the most successful investing teams across the industry, and it's because of our global research footprint. We have this like amazing plethora of resources and research and collaborative culture across the globe that is incredibly attractive, and so we're able to acquire teams when there are gaps in the platform, for instance. We'll go out, but we think that's something that our clients need. We'll go out and find it. We just don't outsource it, by and large. So that's the investing approach. So, you know, I mentioned the next, you know, 10 years won't be like the last. So we're having conversations with clients on a few different things. I mentioned, you know, really looking at the size of your reserves. I think that's very, very important. What are the potential risks to liquidity? Do you have enough set aside, those sorts of things? We're in a really strange environment in terms of bond yields, right? There's a lot of talk about the inversion, which means that actually moving more to cash right now makes a lot more sense than it might in many other environments. So we've been definitely having those conversations with clients. With regard to the long horizon accounts, which is probably the majority of the investments that we advise clients on or the assets that we invest for nonprofits and foundations, we are suggesting that they take a fresh look at their exposure to diversifiers. Those could be liquid, but in many cases they're illiquid. Just those types of assets that have different sources of return and risk than their traditional long-only stocks and bonds, because we are entering into this environment where we feel like you're not going to get paid for return, you know, from a volatility and risk perspective the way that you have certainly over the last 10 years or historically. And so now is a time that it makes sense for those organizations and foundations that are qualified qualified purchasers to invest in, maybe lock up some of their money, really, to ensure, to both improve their returns, but also can dampen the volatility a little bit over time. So that's something we're looking at. The other, I would say, two other things. So revisiting spending, we're suggesting to organizations really look prospectively over what we expect median annualized returns to be for portfolios of your risk profile. Subtract what our median expectation for inflation would be, and that's where you get, okay, here's what you can afford to spend if you're not moving anything else into the portfolio and still maintain your purchasing power. So that is something that we're revisiting with conversations, because looking ahead, that number is quite a bit smaller than it has been historically. And then in terms of net spend, we're having conversations with clients around really thinking creatively about how you can further leverage your investments for impact. So certainly responsible investing or further aligning your investments with your mission, or at a bare minimum avoiding investments in companies or sectors that undermine your mission is one way that you might be able to do that. So it's a worthwhile conversation. And then for foundations, thinking about strategies like program-related investments, for instance, where they could potentially invest in certain investments that are mission-aligned that count towards their 5% required payout, but they're not necessarily grants. They're actually investments. So there's a lot, but, it's revisiting, the fundraising and how dollars are coming in, what you're doing with what you got, and what you're doing in terms of your spending that's going up. The dollars are going still, although I would say it's decreasing. Religion, people giving to religious causes, is like it just dwarfs any other cause out there that individual donors are giving to. And then second to that is education. Both of those are declining, and we're seeing sort of increases in certain areas, like health is one. International giving has actually started to increase quite a bit. The environment, giving to the environmental causes has also started to increase quite a bit more recently. And that's all just data that's out there. I think what we're seeing across our client base, and why I'm part of the philanthropy services team, is it really ties in. And I oversee our endowment and foundation business, and everything with our foundation business, it is that philanthropy. And so it's really a group of folks that are focused on that element of it. So what do we see? Okay, we're seeing some trustees are making around foundation business. We're seeing quite a bit more emphasis, less emphasis on the idea of perpetuity, a foundation lasting for endless generations to come, and more interest in what kind of impact can we make today. Does it make sense for us just to double down, really provide, in some cases, and people will define this differently, but desperate times mean desperate measures, double down and really support specific causes that we care about now, and just sunset the foundation, just shut it down at a certain point and not try to stretch it out over the course of, many generations to come. And then also I would say with that is with this whole massive demographic shift that is going on, we are seeing a lot of families using the foundation or the charitable vehicle as sort of the teaching tool for young adult children. I've had a few meetings with, and I know colleagues have had many more meetings with families where college age sort of next gen members of the family are joining the foundation board and learning about investing and learning about the family's multiple business interests or whatnot through their work on the foundation, that's been interesting, that they're really using it as a teaching tool in some cases, and we're encouraging that too with our clients, so we're proactively out there encouraging that kind of engagement. So those are, what did I give you, four trends? I think the biggest misconception is that people who are impoverished and living in those kinds of circumstances, that they're choosing that in some way, that it may be their fault, or they're, that they're just lazy, right? Or there's a lot of blame. not necessarily explicitly, but implicitly placed on people with the absolute least power and least voice in our society. And having lived for a year and really worked in that arena, and then actually working with adults with special needs and their families in incredibly impoverished communities in Chicago after that, it becomes abundantly clear. You can see all of the roadblocks and all of the challenges that someone encounters from the time they wake up in the morning to, you know, just to take basic transportation. How are you going to pay for it? Like, to get to a job, to get your kids fed. I mean, just all of these different things. It's just not, it pains me when I hear people make comments about that someone's actually on welfare because they're lazy. I just don't buy it. You know, I just don't buy it. And I do think you have to, fortunately, I've never truly been in those shoes. And I say, like, truly fortunately, I'm absolutely grateful for that. I'm absolutely grateful also that I had the experience that I did, where I lived in a situation in a very low-income community and did a year of stipend, you know, volunteer work with women who are homeless, who had absolutely no voice, just to really get to know them, you know, over a sustained period of time and understand their stories.